This podcast is driven by Buick Precision, making every road trip a singular experience.
For almost 2,000 years, it has been shrouded in secrecy, mired in controversy, and the obsession of all those who search for it. The eternal quest for the Holy Grail has inspired countless stories, films, and even a best-selling novel. But just what is it that everyone has been looking for all these years? Many say it's a jewel-encrusted goblet from the Last Supper, or a chalice used to catch the blood of Christ at the crucifixion. Some people think they're one and the same, and yet others don't think it's an object at all, but something less tangible, an ideal of truth or love. Everyone, it seems, has a different opinion about just what and where the Grail is. Our quest for answers begins in Edinburgh, Scotland's majestic capital. Generations of Scottish kings once ruled from the heights of Edinburgh Castle. Today, bagpipers still march through the streets, while the North Sea laps the rocky coast nearby. But just a few miles from this vibrant city lies Rosslyn Chapel, a small church full of big secrets, including, perhaps, the Holy Grail. Thanks to the success of Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code, visitors come to Rosslyn Chapel from far and wide to search for clues. Built in 1446, the chapel stands on a site once used for ancient pagan rituals. Bronze Age carvings have been discovered there, which some archaeologists believe are over 4,000 years old. The chapel's flying buttresses and spooky gargoyles are superb examples of high Gothic architecture. But step inside, and it's obvious this is no ordinary Christian church. Covering every pillar and archway are intricate carvings depicting strange symbols and mystical creatures. At the time of its construction, the symbols would have been considered heresy by the Catholic Church and punishable by death. So who would have risked such an open display of unorthodox spirituality, and why? The mysterious man responsible was named William Sinclair. The Sinclairs were a very old and powerful Scottish family. They lived in a large castle, now in ruins, just behind the chapel. William Sinclair, who commissioned the Rosslyn Chapel, was rumored to be connected to the mysterious Knights Templar. The Knights Templar were originally a humble religious military order of knighthood that was established at the time of the Crusades. Through the years, their membership, wealth, influence, and power increased at a rapid pace. Rumors circulated that along with their money, the secretive organization possessed countless treasures from the times of the Crusades, including the last book of the Gospel, the mummified head of Christ, and even the chalice from the Last Supper. As their wealth and power grew, their ways began to alienate them from the church. When Rosslyn was built, the Catholic Church had officially banned the Templars for their heretic actions. Those who survived hid their priceless treasures, including, it is believed, the mystical chalice, also known as the Holy Grail. Could William Sinclair have secured the final resting place of the Holy Grail in his Rosslyn Chapel? At Rosslyn, several carvings commissioned by Sinclair suggest a connection to the Knights Templar, the five-pointed star, or pentacle, the engrailed crosses, and even a knight on horseback, followed by a cross-bearing angel. But it's the single inscription in the entire chapel that provides the strongest link to the Templars.
What this inscription says is, "Wine is strong, kings are stronger, stronger than these are women, but strongest of all is truth."
Rosslyn is full of mysterious and cryptic figures, and they're not necessarily all the work of the Templars. Could another powerful and mysterious group of the time have left behind their own clues? Even seasoned expert Bob Bryden has yet to successfully decipher the meanings behind the carvings.
The hidden knowledge in Rosslyn Chapel is very difficult. It's in different languages. There's a language of plants, flowers, trees. There's a language of angels with their hands in certain positions. And, of course, there's other languages of codes and other, certainly, languages of biblical meaning.
Some Grail seekers believe Rosslyn's carvings might hide the answers to the location of the Grail, while others believe the Grail is actually hidden in the chapel. One popular rumor is that it is inside the Apprentice Pillar, Rosslyn's most splendid display of carved stone. But X-ray tests have so far dispelled this claim. Alternate theories insist that the Grail and other Templar treasures lie in secret vaults under the chapel floor, but finding out if such vaults exist would mean disturbing both the fragile foundation and the countless dead that are buried there. If the chapel is indeed the resting place of the Holy Grail, it's not likely to be found anytime soon. Spread across the rolling hills and green pastures of central England lies Shugborough Estate, a magnificent example of 18th-century architecture. It's now a living museum. But beyond its elegant facade, this house holds shadowy secrets. Shugborough Estate may have been built by a grandmaster of the Knights Templar. There's an encrypted message on a mysterious monument in the estate, and some say if someone cracks the code, it could reveal the location of the Holy Grail. Shugborough originally consisted of a small manor house and 20 acres of land. In the mid-1800s, all that changed in just a few short years when the owner, Thomas Anson, started pouring money into the estate. With his new and mysterious fortune, Anson transformed the house into a neoclassical mansion filled with exquisite furnishings. In addition to enlarging the house, Anson also designed 10 unique monuments to be placed around the grounds, of which 8 still stand today. Anson called on the leading expert of the time to undertake the construction of these monuments. The monuments suggest a sophisticated appreciation of world cultures. But Anson and Wright also seem to be saying something far more mysterious through the placement of these curious structures. Each monument holds its own secrets. This one was built to resemble the ruins of a Gothic church. Oddly, the pagan figure of a druid sits at the top. Strange rituals are said to have taken place at the Tower of the Winds, and one of Anson's monuments stands out above the rest. It is known as the Shepherd's Monument, and it has sparked over 250 years of furious controversy. The sculpted relief is a copy of the painting called Shepherds in Arcadia by Nicolas Poussin. But the sculpture isn't an exact copy. The scene has been reversed to create the mirror image of the original painting. A pyramid, highly symbolic for both Templars and Freemasons, has been added to the top. Even the position of the shepherd's staffs has been changed. Even more cryptic than the relief is the series of 10 letters carved underneath it.
Somebody is trying to tell us something. They've written out what I call the linguistic code, a series of 10 letters, but very mysteriously arranged so that we've got a row of 8 and flanked by 2 others at a lower line. Nobody knows what this says, and this is the mystery.
Richard Kemp decided it was time to solve this 250-year-old mystery. But instead of asking academics or historians, he called on an unexpected group for help.
We asked the expert code crackers from Bletchley Park, the people who actually helped end the Second World War through their code cracking skills, if they can work out what these letters mean.
Just an hour outside downtown London lies historic Bletchley Park. Today it's a museum and a special events venue, but from 1938 until the end of World War II, this Victorian country estate housed England's top-secret code-breaking operation. Hundreds of young men and women worked in complete secrecy, decoding Nazi radio transmissions. In huts outside the main building, mathematicians labored to decipher messages sent by the Germans using a complex encoding machine called Enigma. To Shugborough Estate's Richard Kemp, it made sense to call on former Bletchley Park code crackers to break the Shepherd Monument's very difficult code.
My feeling on seeing it as a mathematician is that a set of 10 letters, as it is carved on the monument, is a code which is in principle unbreakable. 10 letters is never enough.
Soon the code that could reveal the location of the Holy Grail was finally cracked.
And the word that popped out from his solution was Jesus H. Defy.
Jesus H. Defy is a phrase that refers to a heretical belief closely associated with the Knights Templar, meaning Jesus was entirely human and not divine. But Sheila found a Latin phrase with the same first letters as those on the monument. Translated, it reveals an ancient love note. Best wife, best sister. Widow most loving, vows virtuously. But Thomas Anson had no sister and never married. His sister-in-law Elizabeth died many years after the monument was completed. To this day, the true meaning of the Shepherd's Monument remains a mystery.
If it's a secret coded message to send into the future about the location of the Holy Grail, only meant for those who were supposed to know, then he managed that because we still don't know.
The next stop on our quest is the colorful town of Glastonbury, England. The city streets are lined with shops full of crystals and other magical wares. It's a mecca for spiritual explorers from around the world who are drawn here by Glastonbury's famous earth energies. Known as the Isle of Avalon, Glastonbury's deep connection to the Holy Grail dates back before the time of King Arthur to the earliest days of Christianity. Alternative historian Hugh Le Prevost claims that the first person to possess the Holy Grail, in this case, the chalice from the Last Supper that was later used to catch Jesus' blood, was Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy disciple of Jesus.
Shortly after the crucifixion, Joseph of Arimathea came here. According to legends, he brought the Grail with him to this place. Now, why did he come here? Well, it was outside of the Roman Empire, therefore outside of persecution. This would have been a safe place to be, to come to.
We're on Wirial Hill right now. This is the place where Joseph of Arimathea first came when he came to Glastonbury.
Carrying the chalice in his robes, it is said that he plunged his staff in the ground, and that's when a miracle happened.
And according to legends, that staff sprouted and became the holy thorn tree that we know about today.
This particular tree has a peculiarity that makes it unique.
The thorn tree blossoms twice a year, once at Easter and once at Christmas. And every Christmas, the mayor of the town, he cuts a sprig of the tree that has blossom on it, and it's sent to the Queen of England, and she has it on her dinner table on Christmas Day.
Legend has it that just 4 years after Jesus' death, Joseph of Arimathea founded a church in Glastonbury. Some believe over the years, this humble church evolved into a magnificent and powerful abbey, the greatest Christian church of its time. But in 1184, the abbey burned down. As the monks were preparing the foundations to rebuild it, they made an astonishing discovery.
There was in this area a cemetery which contained two pyramids. And 6 feet down, the monks found a lead cross, and on it it said, "Here lies King Arthur in the Isle of Avalon." And then another 10 feet down, the monks found the bones of a 7-foot man who had 7 wounds in his head, one larger than the rest.
The man was not alone. Lying beside him was a woman whose blonde hair was still intact. According to the famous English legend, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table were on a lifelong quest for the Grail. And although no one knows for sure if King Arthur and his Lady Guinevere even existed, the legend has endured the test of time. As far as Hewlett Prevost is concerned, the remains of the legendary king lie beneath this very spot.
A lot of controversy has existed about these two skeletons. Were they really the bodies of Arthur and Guinevere? Some say they were just forgeries produced by the Benedictine monks for the purpose of raising funds. I personally believe it was the bodies of Arthur and Guinevere.
The bodies were supposedly taken from the ground and placed in the abbey, but the structure was destroyed in 1539. Now that almost another 500 years have passed, there's no way to know for sure the identity of the corpses that were found. But if Arthur is buried here in the abbey, he may be resting just footsteps away from the object of his passionate quest. Many people believe that Joseph of Arimathea buried the Grail below the sacred spring that feeds Chalice Well.
It is said that this cup contained the blood of Christ. And isn't it intriguing that the water, as it flows through the cup, then comes through down the garden, is this brilliant red color. The water running down this waterfall and down to the bottom of the valley, symbolically, the water is running through the cup with the blood of Christ, and it leaves this red stain on the stone.
It's actually the high iron content in the water that taints the rocks red. But many people believe this water has miraculous healing powers, and they come from around the world to drink from Chalice Well. Perhaps the Grail does lie beneath Chalice Well, but those who know the true power of Glastonbury have their own take on what the Holy Grail is and where it lies.
It's not a cup, it's a place. It's a place that leads you inwards, causes you to face yourself, to face the truth that lies within you and awaken that truth. Glastonbury is the Holy Grail.
In our continuing search for the Holy Grail, we journey deep into the heart of England.
In the province of Britannia, what we now call Britain, it was the fourth largest city. It would have been a big place. It would have had a population measured in thousands of people. It covered 80 or 90 acres. The whole city was absolutely crammed with buildings, shops, apartment blocks, the whole works.
By the 4th century, however, Roman rule was coming to an end. The legions were pulled back to the capital, abandoning cities all across the empire.
You began to see the population declining and buildings on the margins are ruined and they're not reoccupied. It's like the end of Roman Britain.
But even after the fall of Rome, during the Dark Ages, this city, which became known as Roxeter, mysteriously managed to prosper. And in the 5th century, it even underwent a massive reconstruction.
Somebody in a position of authority lays everything out in the old city centre. The favourite idea amongst the historical or archaeological community at the moment is that the person in authority might just possibly have been a Christian bishop.
But some experts believe that a powerful warrior was responsible for this epic rebuilding, none other than King Arthur.
The word Arthur in Old British, Brythonic, the language that was spoken at the time, means the bear. Now, there was a figure known as the bear who ruled from a city called Wroxeter, or Viriconium as the Romans called it, and during the time Arthur is thought to have lived, 500 AD, it was in fact the capital of Britain.
Best-selling author and historian Graham Phillips is convinced that this historical King Arthur was the keeper of the Holy Grail.
The last of the treasures from Rome, when Rome was sacked, were brought to Britain, and the place they were brought to, for a while anyway, was to Wroxeter, to its capital. And amongst that was the Chalice of Magdalene.
Legend has it that this cup was found in Jerusalem by the mother of Rome's first Christian emperor, Constantine, and kept in what is today the Vatican. According to Phillips, the Chalice of Magdalene is the Holy Grail, and its significance is more than religious.
If you possess this cup, then in a sense you are the legitimate ruler. Arthur, it seems, was certainly in this country anyway, regarded as like the last emperor because the rest of the empire had collapsed. And having this cup was really his proof that he was the emperor.
And according to Phillips, after Arthur's time, there is no trace of the chalice for many hundreds of years, until it suddenly turns up in this medieval castle.
This is the home of Fulk Fitzwarene in around about 1200 AD. He was a direct descendant of King Arthur, and he was the one who openly boasted to having the Chalice of Magdalene, and he kept it here in a privately built chapel in the castle.
It was during this time that the tales of King Arthur and his quest first appeared in poems and stories.
This is called the White Castle, and the area is called Whittington, which is Old English for White Town. Whittington, White Town. In all the stories of King Arthur, the Grail Guardian, also known as the Fisher King, lived in a castle called the White Castle, in a place called the White Town. So here seems to have been where the entire Arthurian Grail romances began.
The chalice then disappears from all historical records for another 600 years.
The next time it is referenced historically was in the 1850s, where a direct descendant of Fulk Fitzwarene, in fact his last surviving descendant, a man called Thomas Wright, he refers to the fact that he himself still possesses the Chalice of Magdalene. And he lived nearby, about 20 miles from Whittington, near a place called Hawkstone Park, where we are now.
Strangely, this Thomas Wright was also the direct descendant of Thomas Wright, the landscape architect, who built the monuments at Shugborough.
And as he had no children to hand it on to, he decided that what he was going to do was to hide it and leave an almost Arthurian set of clues as a trail to lead to where it was.
To find the hidden chalice, Philip searched for clues in the books that Wright had authored, including A History of Shropshire. In the back of that volume was a mysterious sequence of Roman numerals. He knew they somehow had to be the key to the location of the Grail.
Nobody knew what on earth they were, until in the end I realized that they tied up with the Psalms of the Old Testament. They were biblical references. The first Roman numeral might be 26, and the one underneath it might be, say, 5. It meant Psalm 26, verse 5.
Also in the back of the book was a drawing of Hawkstone Park. With that final clue, Philip started off on the treasure hunt of a lifetime. He came to the park and read the first Psalm verse to begin his search.
Lift up mine eyes unto the hills, lead me to the rock. And it referred to the house of the Lord. Well, it just so happened that at Hawkstone Park, in the middle of the estate, Thomas Wright, on the highest point of the estate, built this ruined chapel, this ruined arch. And it seemed to me that this has got to have been what the first of the references referred to. The second reference, the second psalm, said, "Lead me into the bowels of the earth." Well, it just so happens that right below this arch there are a series of caves cutting through the hillside that have been there since Roman times, where they were used as copper mines. I had to have been onto something. It obviously meant that I had to next go into these caves below the arch. I came down to the entrance to the caves, which is right below the arch, went in to see what I'd find. At the heart of this labyrinth of caves, there's this area that had been cut out at considerable expense by Thomas Wright. It's called the Grotto, and inside here he had four statues erected. Two of them still survive, the lion, the eagle. The other two are recorded as being a bull and an angel. Why he had them put here at that point, I had no idea. So I continued on through the labyrinth of caves, going ever deeper into the heart of the mountain. The next psalm read, "Lead me through the darkness and towards the light." So I just continued through the caves, getting deeper and deeper, wondering if the light would ever come. But in the end, what I did was emerge at the other side of the hill. So I got out of the darkness and finally into the light. Coming out the caves, I found myself in this valley, and it just so happened that the next psalm verse read, "Lead me down the valley to the house of God." Was there going to be a house of God, a church, at the end of this valley? I'd have to find out. This has to have been what Thomas Wright wanted us to find. And when I realised that Hodnet, which is what this little village is called, this is where Thomas Wright himself lived, and this is the 1,000-year-old church that he attended, this has got to have been the place that the clues were alluding to. So let's go check it out.
Thomas Wright had given this magnificent stained glass window as a gift to the church, so Phillips knew it had to contain his next clue.
Here, Thomas Wright has represented four figures, and it says underneath their names the four gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But when you look at one of them to the right, the one that's supposed to be St. John, you notice that it's quite clearly a female figure. Firstly, I mean, the figure hasn't got a beard. And secondly, if you look closely, you'll notice that she's even got breasts. I mean, this is clearly, why is it a female?
The Gospel of St. John alludes to the disciple whom Jesus loved most. This person rested his head on Jesus' bosom throughout the Last Supper.
The church traditionally never liked the idea that Jesus would have had a close female companion. So, because it was written about in John's Gospel, people often, the church traditionally taught that this disciple was St. John. Whereas now, a lot more people tend to think that that disciple was Jesus' only known female disciple, Mary Magdalene. And I think this is what Thomas Wright has done here. He has represented John as Mary Magdalene holding the chalice of Magdalene.
Above each of the four disciples is a mystical figure, an angel, a lion, a bull, and an eagle, the same four figures that had stood as statues in Thomas Wright's underground grotto.
The figure with the chalice, Mary Magdalene or John, directly above that figure is the eagle. So could it be that there was something in the eagle statue? That's what this whole set of clues seem to be leading to.
Phillips raced back to the grotto to examine the eagle statue.
You can still see it's an eagle. There's its breast, its feet are down here, but its head's gone, the base is gone, it's all broken up. And the records show that in the 1920s, somebody was trying to move it, and it fell over and broke. So it seemed that if anything was ever hidden in it, it was probably long since gone. It seemed I was going to have absolutely no chance of ever discovering the chalice of Magdalene.
While reviewing some historical records, Philip stumbled across a tantalizing piece of information.
I found out that in the 1920s, when the statue was being moved and first broken, the man who was moving it recorded that when it was broken, there was a small hollow found in the base, and inside that there was a cup. And I thought, that's it, that's the cup I'm looking for, but it's been found in the 1920s. So I thought, well, that's it, it's gone forever.
Or was it? After extensive research, Phillips tracked down the man's great-granddaughter and asked about the cup that was found in the statue. Her answer exceeded his wildest hopes.
She said, yes, I think we've still got it somewhere. So I went up into the attic where she still had this cup, and it was all wrapped up in old newspapers, from the 1940s newspapers, so it'd been up there for ages and ages. And she opened it up, and there was this small green cup that looked for all the world like a tiny egg cup. This was it, this little cup that had been found in the eagle statue, seemingly the one that had been put there by Thomas Wright, and perhaps the one that had a history going all the way back to, maybe even Mary Magdalene herself.
When Phillips had it analysed by archaeologists at the British Museum, it seemed this simple stone cup, so unlike the ornamental portrayals of the Holy Grail through the centuries, could be the real thing after all.
The first thing that they said was that it was a scent jar, probably dating from the first century, a scent jar of Roman design. Well, that suddenly made sense because, according to the Bible, when Mary Magdalene went and collected drops of Jesus' blood at the Holy Sepulchre, she had taken along a jar containing scent to anoint the body, and it was that that she'd kept the blood of Jesus in. And the interesting thing is that this cup is made from alabaster, and that is what the cup that belonged to Mary Magdalene is supposed to be. She's often referred to as the woman with the alabaster jar, the cup that contained Jesus' blood. This small stone cup may be the Holy Grail, the cup which inspired hundreds of romances. And if it is, it is one of the most sought-after and remarkable artifacts in history.